Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Andrew Muller. Today we're going to be exploring some of the best shows coming up on offer in London this season, and taking me through some of those exhibitions is the editor-at-large for the Art newspaper. There's a clue in the name there, Jane Morris. Jane, welcome to the show.
Hello.
We will start with the Royal Academy of Arts Much Ballyhooed. I think we're entitled to call it Much Ballyhooed, Abstract Expressionism exhibition. This does feature a rare outing from its Australian home for Jackson Pollock's No. 11, 1952, better known as Blue Poles, among much else. I mean, it's a huge, ambitious exhibition because it's trying to get a lot in there. Does it succeed in doing that?
To an extent. It is the biggest show, I think, of abstract expressionism that's been put together for about 50 or 60 years since a major show at the Tate. And they have gathered together around 150 works, some of them really famous, including the Blue Poles that you've just mentioned that's come from Australia. It's curated by David Anfam, who's a consultant curator at the Clifford Steel Museum in Denver, and a well-known expert on abstract expressionism. And they've basically, as I say, collected together 150 works. It's the giant names. So it is the Jackson Pollocks, the Mark Rothkos, the Willem de Koonings, the Clifford Steels, the Robert Motherwells.
It's the greatest hits.
It's not all the greatest hits. A lot of the greatest hits probably travel very rarely, actually. But nonetheless, they have managed to borrow some great works from places like the Metropolitan Museum, the MoMA, and so forth. So it's an impressive show, and if you're remotely interested in abstract painting, it is a must.
You say it's the biggest exhibition of this scale of abstract expressionism for 50 or 60 years, which actually seems extraordinary anyway. I mean, I realise the logistics are difficult, but do they now seem as particular reactions to a particular period? Are they kind of like isolated in time as we look at them from half a century away?
Yes, I think for me that was possibly one of the slight, if I say, shocks of the show. Like a lot of people, seeing Mark Rothko's Seagram Building paintings in the old Tate, which is now Tate Britain, was quite a formative experience for me when I was about 14 or 15. And you'll find many people who first saw Rothko in London say that thing. And now, of course, obviously I'm somewhat older, but now going around the exhibition, I did think how, to some extent, the works, of course, do now look dated. I mean, it does feel like a historical show. That's not to say that there aren't great works in the show, and there are, and some of the things that have been put in, some of the juxtapositions are very interesting. I slightly felt that I knew this story. As I say, if you've never had chance to see any of these paintings, if you don't travel a lot, then absolutely this is a must show. But I did feel that we were being told a story that to some extent I know. The thesis of the show is to show us that the very classic way that abstract expressionists are often looked at is that some of them are gestural, like mm-hmm. Pollock, and some of them are colour field painters like Mark Rothko. And the aim of the show is to show that the story is a bit more complex. So there are artists like Philip Guston in there, for example, who in fact went back to figurative painting in the sort of 60s. And in that way, it is interesting. But I suppose one of the things that I was slightly surprised about was that there weren't more of the people who are somewhat peripheral to the story. So there is one painting by Norman Lewis, who is the only black abstract expressionist who was in the 1950 Studio 35 discussions about what abstract mm-hmm. expressionism was. There's a few paintings by women. And I'm not just saying this as an identity politics issue, more that I think it would have been nice to have seen a few more surprising people in there, particularly for people who do feel quite sort of grounded in this history.
Is there also a factor with it that a lot of these paintings at the time and not long afterwards had considerable power to shock? I mean, I speak as an Australian, and I can't really remember the fuss at the time, but I'm aware there was a fuss when the Australian government under Gough Whitlam decided to spend $1.3 million of Australian taxpayers' money to purchase Blue Poles for the National Gallery. The response to that was extraordinary. People completely freaked out. 40-odd years later, it's probably the best money an Australian government spent in my lifetime.
Absolutely. But, and one of the stories that is touched on in this exhibition is the degree to which two women, Peggy Guggenheim and Betty Parsons, who were gallerists at the time, helped develop these people's careers. But Peggy Guggenheim put on the very first show of Jackson Pollock. And I think the prices were somewhere between something like 2 $250 to $750, and not one of them sold. And now I believe the top price for a Jackson Pollock is probably around $140 million. But, you know, if a really great one came up, like the Blue Poles, who knows what it would fetch.
And is also, there's also the fact that Rothko in particular has now, in terms of his legacy, has he become a victim of his success? Because his paintings, again, which at the time were quite discomforting and quite confronting, I mean, have become cliches of urban good taste, haven't they?
Well, I think that, as I say, I think if you get the chance to go to the Tate, and now, of course, they're in the new Tate Modern, and you see the Seagram Building murals together, I still think they have considerable power. I don't feel the presentation at the Royal Academy achieves that level. I think in an effort to show as much work as they could, they were a bit inclined to cram in too many works. Mm-hmm. So you don't get that experience of one-to-one with a single work. And I think with the benefit of hindsight, they may consider that a mistake. I certainly felt there was a little bit too much in there for you to have that kind of experience. I think these things, again, go in and out of fashion. I mean, there were some Rothkos displayed at Venice at the Biennale a few years ago, and everyone felt that they suddenly were reminded about how good Rothko was and his how sort of emotionally powerful he can be.
Okay, well, Abstract Expressionism's at the Royal Academy of Art until January the 2nd. We should look now at the Alison Jack Gallery here in London as well for an exhibition of Dorothea Tanning's flower paintings. It's just six paintings, right?
Yes, it's six paintings and some drawings. I suppose we're going a bit mid-century modern here, and although these paintings were made later, Dorothea Tanning is pretty much contemporaneous with the artists in the Abstract Expressionism.
She did live a very, very long time.
She did. She was born around 1910, so these paintings were made quite near the end of her life. I think they were made in the late 1990s. But they're these gorgeous, lush paintings. She made 12 of them, and six here. Gorgeous lush flower paintings. I mean, I think it is quite funny. The Time Out noted, and I thought it was quite witty, that you wait years and years and years, and then you get two women doing big, sexy flower paintings at the same time. So Dorothea Tanning and Georgia O'Keeffe, obviously, still on at Tate Modern.
One more. I think the journalistic rule is two is a coincidence, three is a trend.
Yes.
And so if there was a third, then we get all the articles about why are women all painting huge pictures of flowers?
Indeed, indeed, indeed. But I say it's a lovely show. It's quite small. It's free because it's a commercial gallery. And I think these paintings, they're just so luscious. They're the most gorgeous shades of kind of yellowy ochre and mauves and greys. I mean, they're really lovely, lovely things. And again, there is another connection because Dorothea Tanning met her later on husband, Max Ernst, because he came to look at her work on behalf of Peggy Guggenheim, who was checking her out for a potential show. So once again, we see the hand of Peggy Guggenheim, who was one of the great gallerists of her age, as well as setting up the famous museum in Venice.
Is Dorothea Tanning one of those figures, and it's far from unheard of across all fields, of a woman whose works might be better known if she hadn't married somebody more famous?
It's hard to say that. I mean, I think the art market of the sort of 50s, 60s, even the 70s was quite a hard place for women, African Americans, I mean, people who just didn't fit the white male stereotype. I mean, in fairness, it was quite a hard place for anyone to make a living. There wasn't that much money in the art market of this period. And I think that it cuts both ways. Because of her friendship with Ernst, she got a gallery and she got exhibitions. She did also, of course, initially make her own name in her own right, a bit like Georgia O'Keeffe. It's a bit of a complex tale, that one.
I mean, she had a very long career because she had a very long life, obviously. I think I'm right in saying she was 101 when she died in 2012. But she did many other things. She was a sort of surrealist painter, a figurative painter, an author, a poet. Do the flowers seem congruent to the body of work, or do they seem a separate excursion, which, as you say, she embarked on quite late in life?
Oh, I think they fit in, and I think you can see that hint of surrealism in these final paintings. So for me, they're not a weird aberration.
Okay, well, let's also have a look at, well, before we do that, we should remind everybody that Dorothea Tanning's flower paintings are at the Alison Jack Gallery until October 1st, which is only this weekend, so do be quick. Finally, we should look to Hauser & Wirth and Ligia Pape, which we think is how it's pronounced. This is what we have been advised by our Brazilian producer.
Indeed. I must say, I've heard that name pronounced so many different ways, but we will go with Ligia Pape.
I guess the place to start with Ligia Pape is introduce her, if you will.
Okay, so we are again mid-century. We're back in the 1950s, but this time we are in Brazil. And Brazil was a very dynamic place at this period. Oscar Niemeyer is busy rebuilding the architecture of Rio and other buildings in Brazil. The country is at this point quite forward-looking. It's embracing modernism with enthusiasm. And around this time, the Sao Paulo Biennial gets set up, which for many, many years was the second most important after the Venice Biennale. So there's a big artist community there. And in the middle of all this, a group emerges that become called the neo-concretists. And Ligia Pape is one of them, along with Ligia Clark and Elio Otisica. And they are really quite a radical group, I suppose. The concretes, to whom they are reacting against, is kind of where they started as well. This is a sort of geometric, rigid sort of art form. It bears no relationship to the observed world, or it doesn't have symbolic meaning. So they called it concrete as opposed to abstract for that reason. But after a while, this group, Ligia Pape, Ligia Clark and Elio Otisica, became, I think, tired of the sort of rigours and rigidity of this particular movement, which is very similar to constructivism. And they start to go off in their own direction. And one of the directions they go into is making 3D works that come from that geometric basis, but 3D works, interactive works, they start playing around. She's really famous as being part of this really important group who, to some extent, were forgotten. And then from the 70s, 80s onwards, their reputation has been rising and rising and rising, and people have come to realise how important and innovative they were.
So when you go along to Hauser & Wirth, what does the exhibition actually consist of? What are you going to see?
OK, this is, again, a very tightly curated show, I would say. The first thing you see is a video, and it's a cube sculpture with Ligia Pape herself kind of crawling in and out of it. Then there are two sculptures and some of her woodcut works. But the absolute standout piece is one of her, she called them titeias, and it's a geometric sculpture. It's in a darkened room and it's metal strings drawn across the space that you can walk around with lights shining, sort of shimmering down the wires. It's an absolutely beautiful piece. A gold version was shown in the Venice Biennale in 2009, and everyone suddenly went, wow. And it's really interesting because only really Otisica and a little extent Mira Shandell, in Brazil, people were making these kind of incredible installations in the 60s and 70s. And this is long before the installation art that we all know now from the 90s and 2000s. And I think it's been quite a surprise for people to realise that this was going on, not in the West, out in Latin America, and really very innovative, original and, you know, very atmospheric work.
Well, that's Ligia Pape at Hauser & Wirth until November 19th. Before we let you go, though, we do need to talk about news late last week of the 2017 Venice Biennale.
Well, this is a bit nerdy, but everyone in the art world is a bit obsessed about Venice, it has to be said. It's one of the places where you see, A, what's going on in the art world and what artists and curators are doing, and B, it does have an influence on the art market. If people have an exciting or surprising show at Venice, you very often see a rush, a little bit like Ligia Pape, who has just been signed by Hauser & Wirth. You often see a rush to sign up artists or artists' estates. So basically, we've got the theme and title of this year's exhibition. It's been curated by Christine Massel, who is the chief curator of contemporary art at the Pompidou. It's called Viva Arte Viva. Now, like all these kind of big Biennale titles, they're always a bit elusive and some might say something of a catch-all because there's going to be 100+ odd artists showing. So how do you fit
them
all?
They have to call it something and they can't just say stuff.
No, exactly, or just give it a number. I mean, it's interesting that Documenta, which is also going to be on next year, just has a number, Documenta 14. But basically what's been quite interesting here is that she's used some quite suggestive words and she's been talking about reflection and individual expression and work having a spiritual dimension. It's not the kind of language we've heard terribly lately. In fact, it's not the kind of language we've really heard. And since, in many cases, the abstract expressionists. So I think this is going to be a very art inward looking, imaginary world, immersive kind of art experience, probably a very direct opposite of what Ockham Wazore did 2 years ago, which was a highly politicised biennial, very much about the violence of capitalism and colonialism and things like that.
Well, we look forward to seeing how that develops. But that does bring us to the end of today's show. Jane Morris from the Art Newspaper, thank you for joining us. You have been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Andrew Muller. The producer was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for our music review. But for now, thanks for listening and goodbye.